in practicing is you really can notice a lot more. You can get interested, your mind can get interested in all kinds of things. Your ideas and theories about, you know, what's going on, and it's like we focus a lot on other people sometimes. Eventually you might get curious about our own ideas and theories. Stuff that just flies by usually, you know, because we're too busy coping. We don't have much time to think about anything. Except me to worry about the things that we're coping with. So the practice is such a great thing because it can help us sort of get beneath the surface and look at, well, what is this me that's coping, you know? How do I work? And what is all this stuff that I think I'm coping with? How does it actually, is it really the way I think it is? My Zen teacher used to say that everyone's a philosopher, you know? Everyone is a philosopher. Meaning that we all have our theories, you know? We all have our philosophy. Maybe because it's just like true, we don't think about it that much. You know? It's just me. And you're you. And I know what you're like. So it's interesting being in an intimate circumstance, goes in with all these other people and not talking, because then sometimes various things happen and we may have occasion to doubt some of our theories and learn something new. Which is sometimes quite delightful and sometimes a little bit, or a lot bit, difficult and unpleasant, you know? So everything's included. So I've been calling these retreats here that we do in August and up October, roots retreats. The roots of compassion, the roots of mindfulness. So what's a root? See what I mean? It's fun, you can kind of slow down and think about these things. Well, what is a root anyway? You know, roots anchor plants in the earth. We tend to say roots go deep. That's not always true, actually. If you've seen like a fir tree or a cedar tree turned over in the forest around here, they're not that deep, actually. It's like this big, broad array of roots. So roots are broad, too, kind of going out in all directions. The tree is stabilizing itself. You can't see it, right? It's under the soil. The tree is stabilizing itself with a broad base of roots. They don't necessarily go so deep. So we all need roots, too, I think. Roots to hold us up. Roots to give us water and nourishment. We get so dehydrated, you know, in every way. Spiritually dehydrated, psychologically dehydrated, physically dehydrated. It's funny being in like the stress reduction trade and you realize that actually some really simple things might make more of a difference than all these elaborate theories that are, you know, verified by neuroscience, like drinking more water, you know. Stretching a little more, you know. People would be a lot less stressed. We just remembered to do some simple self-care things. But then we also, I think, need to inquire deeply into who and what we are as well. So there's many kinds of roots. But the roots that we're focusing on are Buddhist traditional roots. That are part of what seem to be behind or beneath these contemporary practices that we've all met in various ways. They get known by little curricula, like mindfulness-based stress reduction is a curriculum, mindful self-compassion is a curriculum with a bunch of pieces that happens in a particular context, which also matters. So it's not just the stuff you do. It's where you do it and with whom you do it, the feeling with which you do it. But many of those pieces and much of the feeling, I think, is really sourced from a certain quality of experience that Buddhism seems to have really explored deeply for a long, long time. So I think the Buddhist roots are important, but it doesn't mean that what you've been doing in those classes is Buddhist, exactly. And of course, what does Buddhist mean anyway? That's another story, you know? What do all these categories actually mean that we divide the world up into? Are they really real in the way that we think they are? So we want to focus on a set of teachings that are in four areas, a set of practices that are called in Buddhism Brahma Vihara. And we will attempt to speak in English in these talks and not drift into the intricacies of these old traditions. And neither Uri or I are really scholars or specialists anyway, so we would just be doing a hack job if we tried to. But there are some terms that are commonly used, and terms that translation into English is always a little bit tenuous. So we'll mention a few words in Asian languages as well. Mostly with these teachings, because they're from early Buddhism, the Pali language is used. Pali is the language of South India that the Buddhist teachings were first written down in, right around the birth of Christ, around that time period. So Brahma Vihara, Brahma is a god actually, Indian god. So these are religious teachings, not necessarily practical psychological teachings. Brahma can refer to sort of an embodied god, usually depicted as male, or more like a cosmic sort of principle. And it's an idea much earlier, much older than Buddhism. So that's Brahma, Brahma Vihara. Vihara is a hall or a monastery. So we're in a Vihara right now, Samish Vihara. So these are the practices for entering the godly halls. I hope that's okay. But we can apply it in various ways, I think. We'll see. One thing, though, is that the goals of early Buddhism are actually a little bit different from what our goals might be in contemporary mindfulness and compassion class. That these are teachings not for personally feeling a little better, exactly. They're not designed so that we'll become less stressed or kinder, although that may happen. But these are actually teachings for radical transformation, for transporting us so that we're living our life in the halls of Brahma. And actually, this particular term, Brahma Vihara, also predates Buddhism. And one of Buddha's insights was that even though it sounds really great to end up in heaven, and the Vedic traditions of India and Buddhism have heaven, actually multiple heavens, it might not be quite as great as we think it is. It would definitely be blissful. And they describe the heavenly realms in great detail in early Buddhist texts. They're really into jewels, I think, because they talk about the jeweled trees. Everything's made out of jewels. And they like food and smells. They talk a lot about the heavenly perfumes and the delicious food of the heavens. The streams like are running not just with water, but like a delicious nectar that you can drink. It's like the best thing you ever drank, you know? The Coca-Cola company would be going nuts. But actually, you don't even have to lean down and drink it. You have gorgeous servants that wait on you all the time. And they take like the golden ladle and they scoop it up, the nectar, ambrosia stream water, and, you know, dribble it in your mouth when you think the thought that that would be good. They appear and do that. So you're just totally blissed out and happy. Everything's provided, you know, everything you can imagine. It's just the best. And so this is a common sort of goal in religion. But the Buddha's insight was, even this gets old, you know, even this gets old. And his other great insight was that everything is impermanent, even heaven. Even your life in heaven is not permanent. So it's a little different from my limited understanding of Christian heaven. I think that's kind of like permanent. So eventually, a few thousand years later, you start to feel a little unsatisfied with this wonderful situation. Because you kind of can't do anything, you know, but be blissed out. And I read recently that you know your things are going on the downhill side because you start to smell funny and the servants lose interest in you and forget you're there. And then eventually you die, even as a god, you die and are reborn. So this teaching comes from a very different kind of frame. Because to just be blissed out means we can't really be free. We're caught up in it, you know? And that was the Buddha's actual goal. It's a certain kind of freedom. A release not just from bad stuff, but a release from everything that you experience being sort of contingent on everything else. I want that, so I get this, we think, you know? If only, we say. And you can certainly study that in great detail at retreat. Greed is a great place to study desire and aversion. That breakfast was pretty good, but, you know, she held the door for her, but why did she not wait for me? You know, little things can loom large. And of course, we're in a bigger situation here, even though we're on retreat, we're still in the western part of the continent that's on fire, you know. There's plenty of things that aren't the way we want them. And Buddhism is not so much about just accepting it a little better, but being really freed up, unruffled by everything, completely accepting of what is, without the moment's bit of yeah, but, you know, this is how it is, and I can work with it, I can be with it, I can practice in it and among it. And that kind of freedom, depending on how you apply it, can allow you to just happily sort of fade off somewhere else, or it can enable you to stick around in this messy world and get to work without any extra baggage, you know, helping people with a kind of complete openness of heart and love with no strings attached because you're free from needing strings. So the Buddha, in that system, which is a little different from our way of thinking, said, well, the best thing is to be born as a human, actually. Why? Because humans have just enough suffering. If we didn't have any suffering like in the heavenly realms, we wouldn't get around to doing any of this kind of practices and stuff. If we had too much suffering, and there's other realms, you know, there's hellish realms, then we're too consumed by our suffering and we can't practice. And that seems a little far out, though. We can reflect on every day or every week or every year of our life. Aren't we sometimes a little checked out, you know? Briefly, at least, in the heavenly realm. You know, that's pleasant, but can't really practice then. And aren't we quite a few times really, like, consumed and overloaded and overwhelmed, you know? And unable to really practice. So the Buddha said it's good to be suffering a little bit because it helps you understand I have work to do here if I'm going to be free and of benefit to myself and others. So we want to mention some of these teachings that the Buddha suggested and see if we can a little bit translate them into practical stuff that we can do this week. And also just bring some of it up because it's interesting. And part of my goal in giving these talks is also just to give a little entertainment, you know. Who wants to just sit in the middle of your head all day? So it's okay to take a little break with some ancient Buddhist teachings. So the Brahma-Vihara instructions, I have four parts, four areas. And the first is love, is metta, or loving kindness. Sorry, I'm kind of on the fly deciding that I went on a little too long in my planned introduction, so I'm kind of editing. One second. So first area of practice, so that we can find the Brahma-vihara of real freedom, is loving-kindness, is metta. And it's interesting, this term from Pali, metta, like, loving-kindness is kind of like glomming two English words together, usually with a hyphen in between. So there's not exactly an English word for this. Sometimes people just say kindness, but that doesn't seem quite active enough. Maybe kindliness. Kindliness. To emphasize that there's a kind of inherent process here. It's a practice, not like a sort of a state. We say, oh, she's so kind. But then we can say to ourselves, I need to practice kindliness, you know, practice kindness. Maybe many of you have already practiced loving kindness meditation. We'll do several versions of this practice this week. And it's a practice to help us nourish our inherent quality of kindliness, that we all have this in us. And in the instructions, they talk about kindness, metta, loving kindness, towards all beings, towards all beings. All beings is a wonderful Buddhist term, too, which you can just kind of slip by quickly. Oh yeah, all beings, sure, yeah, I'm on board with that. But it's worth pausing to reflect on this little phrase for a moment, all beings. This means all beings without exception are the recipients of our kindness, our love, our practice of this metta. And that includes, you fill in the blank, those many beings that we may feel with some part of ourselves do not deserve our kindness. But these are not sort of political debates or practical actions. It's an internal work that leads to practical actions, and I hope leads to political change. But we start here. And many of these teachings are kind of like a recipe. You know, you're reading this recipe, and you're saying to yourself, well, this sounds good. But you actually have to follow the recipe to find out, right? And sometimes people get excited about collecting teachings, you know? Like, it's like collecting recipes. And you know, we know how silly it would be to tear the page out of the cookbook and eat it, right? So these teachings are not exactly like that kind of thing. You can't just sort of eat them, you know, and say, oh, I heard a great teaching and everything's better. That'd be like eating the page from the cookbook. You actually have to, like, work your way through the recipe. And this can take a while. These are recipes that take quite a while to cook. You know how it often says on there, you know, 15 minutes, great for after work. These are like the 10, 20 year recipes, or the multiple life recipes. And just like in a cooking recipe, sometimes in the middle we start to have a little doubt, you know. Do we really have to do all this stuff? Does it really need that ingredient? I'm out of that. Can I use this instead? So some effort and patience is required. You get halfway through the recipe and say, this is kind of lame. There's, you know, they left out the salt. I'm going to put in salt. It might not end up tasting quite right. Or maybe you doubt yourself in the middle of trying to do the recipe. I don't really know how to knead bread. Need dough. I don't really know how to knead the dough, so I'll just throw the dough in the oven just like that, you know. And you get a brick, not a loaf of bread. So these teachings are recipes that we need to work with and cook with. So this idea that all beings, without exception, deserve our love and our kindness is in the recipe. And we might right away say, yeah, I don't know about that. But we haven't cooked the dish yet, right? So we don't know. Which is not to say that we should blindly accept all this as true, whatever true means. And the Buddha was a little doubtful about that kind of idea of truth anyway. But these are instructions to work with, to practice with, to do over time, and see what happens, see how it comes out. If in the end you don't like the dish, then there's a lot of other recipes out there. Gotta do the work. But work sounds not quite right, you know? That's why we're really fond of this word practice. So we have endless practice in this field without any performances ever, you know? Just more practice. Or the practice is the performance. Practice is the work. We're always refining, and we don't have any idea of ever getting it right. Because there's always more practice, more cooking to do. So the best-known traditional Buddhist source on how to work with these teachings, the Brahma-viharas, which start with metta, loving-kindness, is a 5th-century work, quite a long commentary on the Buddhist tradition and an attempt to organize it. I heard a Buddhist scholar say it was kind of like somebody took a whole lot of folk medicine and organized it into a medical school textbook or something. It's like the medical school textbook of Buddhism for the physicians in the room. This is a long book by a 5th century Sri Lankan monk named Buddhaghosa. So 5th century, now we're actually a millennia, 1,000 years more or less, after the Buddha's life. And for the first 500 years, the Buddha's teachings weren't even written down at all. So I was just thinking about that, and I thought, well, would my relatives 500 years from now remember the things that I said, you know, the important things that I said? Probably not, you know. But the Buddha was a particularly important relative, so the monks made a great effort to remember what he said. And actually, one of the main practices for the first centuries of the Buddhist tradition was just the practice of reciting the teachings. People would specialize in different sections, and that's what you do every day, like recite for hours, you know. This lives on in Waldorf education, actually, which is great. Kids there do lots of recitation. We're not so good at recitation mostly anymore, or memorizing anything. And then now Google has completely eliminated whatever ability we had left, you know. Anyway. So is this really what the Buddha said? Who knows? But it's in a tradition of practice that began with a being that we're pretty sure existed, that we now call the Buddha. Somebody wrote this recipe, and a lot of people have cooked from it, and there have been some killer meals, so it's worth exploring. So anyway, Buddhaghosa says, well, the first thing to do, if you want to take up the practice of being more loving, the practice of loving kindness, is to deeply recognize and admit how much you practice the opposite of that. And he calls the opposite of loving kindness hatred. And hatred sounds really stark. That's a bit much. We're all nice people here. We don't go around hating people. That sounds a little extreme, so maybe we can consider other words in that realm to bring this home to us. How about annoyance? Do you practice annoyance? How about impatience? How about grumpiness? How about wanting other people to be some other way than the way they are? That's all kind of, I think, shades of what he's talking about when he uses the term hatred. Of course, he was using another language anyway. And again, this comes up. This comes up here, where we have time and space to notice it. But the great kind of turning of it to where it becomes something that we can practice with and learn from is when we notice it a little more for what it is. It requires a little persistence and curiosity. And a kind of separation of the stories that come up in our heads. I should have, she should have, they should have. To, well, what is this actually? Oh, this is impatience. Wow. kind of like Uri was saying, what am I actually feeling and doing right now? Oh, I'm practicing being grouchy. And I have lots of good reasons, you know. It's completely justified. Yeah, maybe. But that element's there too, right? And that's where change and freedom is possible. I think we've all tried really hard the rewriting the stories method. We're pretty good at it. But the suggestion of these practices is rewriting the story is not enough. Because we're stuck still in what? The story. So Buddhaghosa says, you want to practice loving kindness, understand the ways that you practice the opposite. Grouchiness, hatred, impatience. Really notice it. Don't just brush past it or talk yourself out of it or pretend it didn't happen. Notice those little flashes of anger, annoyance, and study them. What does that feel like? How does it show up in the body? Does it change? Does it move? What kind of other thoughts and feelings and emotions get attracted to it, you know? Anger is glue for all kinds of narratives, right? Does it persist a long time on its own, or do you feed it, or you wake up the next morning and it's gone? Like, why was I so annoyed about that? Jeez, you know, no big deal at all. I think a lot of the sort of valuable insights and practices at retreat don't actually happen in here, you know. They happen in your room or the dining hall or walking around. You can kind of notice things shift. Maybe this is all supported by the formal practices we do in here. We like to think so because that's why we put a lot of it on there, but we don't really know. So in each of these four areas, we'll get into the other three later, they say, yeah, first study the opposite, which they call the far enemy. So we're trying to sort of be allied with love. So we need to notice the enemies of love. And there are far enemies and near enemies. Far enemies are kind of the obvious opposites, although even though they're relatively obvious, we don't always even notice them. I've really tried to make a big study the last several years of anger because I became kind of a champion anger repressor, partly using meditation, and it was not helping me, you know. But what I notice about anger is that I usually don't notice anger. I subsume it into something else, you know. I'm like, oh, it's okay. He's just that way. But actually, there's anger there, you know. It works better if I notice it, you know, work with it. So noticing the far enemies. They also talk about near enemies, like the far enemy's right in front of you, you know, with a sword and stuff, and it's easy to see her, you know. She's terrifying, actually. The near enemy is kind of like at your side, like whispering in your ear, you know. So the near enemy of loving kindness is desire, certain kinds of desire, greediness, kind of greedy desire. You know, you're trying to orient towards somebody with kindness, but you notice there's a kind of a stickiness to it, right? Some strings attached. You want something in exchange. Which in the middle of this almost loving kindness, you find perfectly normal and justified, right? It's the least she could do. Goodness, you know. All these years I've been, and she's still, and what, you know? So this is not actually loving kindness, but a close cousin, you know. Can still be beneficial, but it's not free. It's stuck. Sometimes you think you're being quite kind to somebody, but somehow they don't react the way you think they should, or the universe gives you some other signals, you know. But we're often pretty stubborn about our theory. We know that we're right, and they just don't get it. So that's another thing we can study in our practice. When that narrative comes up, whatever your version of it, to get curious about whether we're just a little off the mark, you know, whether we're actually practicing this near enemy of loving kindness, a kind of sticky desire, tainted. They use the word tainted a lot in Buddhism, a little tainted, you know. Could be pretty pure, you know. But that's where the Buddha's vision was really big, you know. He's like, don't settle for 93% pure kindness. Go all the way to 100, you know. But what I think is it's great to have both these kind of radical, and they're pretty radical actually, teachings of Buddhism, like complete freedom, you know, no suffering. It's good to have that as a vision. But it's also good to appreciate that you feel a little better if you're just a little less distracted and a little less angry and a little less caught by greed and desire, you know. It's really great being 93% kind, actually. That'd be fine, you know, that'd be fabulous. You know? So much nicer than 43%. You know? So we can have both ultimate liberation or whatever, and wouldn't it be nice to be a little happier, a little kinder, a little gentler, a little more understanding, a little wiser. So we can notice the near enemies and the far enemies of loving kindness as a great and an essential way to open the door to a deep practice of transformational kindness. So back to hatred. In this vast book that I was looking at, he has several suggestions for working with our hatred, more than I would even have time for in multiple talks. But I couldn't resist a few of them. And if you want to like be a Buddhist geek, I can send you the PDF. You can read them all later. The first one is very simple. Just apply loving kindness towards the person that is the recipient of your anger. Hold the image of that person in your heart, whether you're seeing them right now physically or not, and use language of loving kindness, which we'll practice. Offering them good wishes, saying to yourself, and really meaning it, something like, may you be happy, may you be joyful, may you feel safe, may you be healthy and strong and live with ease, may everything just go great with you, you know, whether you feel like it or not. So this is cooking to the recipe. We have some limited views about emotional change, that we have to sort of be in the mood, or it has to feel like authentic or something like that. And the frame of this is very different than that. It doesn't get caught by that. It just says, well, just cook the recipe anyway, you know? It doesn't matter whether you feel like it or not. It's just one factor of many. You receive these teachings, so apply them. So hold the person you're angry with in your heart, including yourself. So that's the other thing about all beings, it's very powerful. I know Uri wants to emphasize in his talks, which is great. We are radically included in this wish for more kindness towards all beings. May I be happy. I'm such a... May I be happy. May I be happy. May I don't really mean it. May I be happy. You know? At least happier, you know. At dinner, someone was mentioning the ABC News anchor, Dan Harris, who's now a meditation evangelist. And he has a book and a podcast called 10% Happier. When I first heard that, I thought, that's a pretty low bar, you know? Only 10%, you know? Come on, you know? I thought, well, that's still pretty good. It's like compounding interest. 10% and then 10%, more of the 10%, you know, gradually. We get happier, kinder. More loving. I deserve kindness, may I be happy. Anyway, so Buddhaghosa says, start with that, you know, pretty simple. Just apply this practice, and this really can change things. Then he says, if that doesn't work, contemplate examples of great beings and teachers who've responded to hateful things with patience and kindness. And the Buddhist tradition is replete with just outrageous stories of the Buddha doing this, often in past lives. But we can think of contemporary examples too, if we're not bought into that particular system. Look, I've been thinking a little bit about Nelson Mandela lately, and renewing my intention to learn more about him. That when he was liberated from Robben Island, he was able to forgive his jailers and tried to transform his country with truth and reconciliation. Currently things are not so great there, but still this incredible example. Focus on that. I looked it up. He was imprisoned there, literally breaking rocks with a hammer. from 1964 to 1982. Can you imagine that? 18 years. And there's many other examples to really bring these to mind, and then actually to spend some time learning about these things. We're pretty good about learning about all kinds of things in the age of instant information availability. So why don't we direct some of our learning time towards learning about great people, you know, with this incredible, who demonstrate this incredible human capacity to meet pain and suffering and oppression with compassion and love. Not to let that just be something we hear about randomly, but learn about these beings and contemplate them and bring them up deliberately, you know, when you're pissed off at somebody, you know. Okay. Help me, Nelson Mandela. Please help me. So there's a lot of humility to this too. A lot of humility. And then he says, well, if that doesn't work, this goes on for a long time, I'm just giving you the highlights. If that doesn't work, remember how harmful it is to you and to the other person. It's nothing but harmful to fan the flames of anger. And he gives a list of ways you might cause harm. You might think to yourself, he says, to the, you know, you're thinking about the other person. You might think, may you be ugly. He says that in there. And he says, that just makes you ugly. May you lie in pain. It causes pain in you. Yes, and then the last one he says is, you may think, let them have no friends. And what does that result in? Not so many friends, you know. So indulging in anger, even when we think it's justified, constricts our life. We end up impoverished, friendless, and ugly. The final example is pretty great. It says, if you're really caught up in this, you might have the thought, as a log from a pyre, burnt at both ends and fouled in the middle, serves neither for timber in the village nor for timber in the forest, so is such a person as this. She's like a nasty log, you know, burnt at both ends and fouled in the middle. And what does that lead to, thinking that thought? The Buddha says, by repaying an angry person in kind, you will be worse than the angry person. You will yourself do to yourself the things that you heap on your enemy. You will be like a pyre log. So we really don't want to make ourselves into burnt up, shit-covered logs. That's what they're saying in here. Ancient teaching. Very important. It's true though, isn't it? You know? We diminish ourselves. We put a spin on it and a nice face on it, but we do this. So what I love about this tradition, it's difficult, but this incredible invitation towards honesty. We are kind, we are generous, and we can be pretty nasty. And these teachings saying, don't just brush that aside. Face it, bring it up, see what it does. Feel through it. And then eventually, you can't help it. Naturally, you do it less because it hurts too much. Sometimes it sounds like these teachings are for sort of getting rid of our stress and suffering, but actually they involve embracing our stress and suffering and learning from our stress and suffering and being healed by our stress and suffering. So then he says, you still here? Still angry and hateful? Well, consider this. And here we need a little worldview shift at first, but then it'll work, I think. He says in there, since all beings are subject to rebirth, and since we're being reborn again and again in an endless cycle, so time is circular in the system, then it stands to reason that the person you're angry with was most definitely in lots of different relationships with you in past lives. And therefore, that person was most definitely, at least one time, your mother. So this person you think is a total whatever, to actually really understand this is your mother, the one who cared for you and brought you into the world is right in front of you. And you repay her kindness like this? Yeah. Now, that's a little hard for us, I think, literally. But we can also play with our perspective when we're angry, hateful, by bringing gratitude to the many, many people and beings who've helped us be who we are. To try to free ourselves from the mistaken view that it's just me, that this is just me, I'm the one who did all this. And we know how ridiculous that would be, right? We couldn't be any of this without so many others. We're riding on the shoulders of millions, thousands, infinite numbers of beings, you know, made our life possible. So you could bring a few of those to mind. That can shift your perspective. Or you can try this literally. What if this awful politician who's doing these incredibly terrible things is actually my mother? You know? She may be a little confused, you know, she may need a little guidance from me at this point, you know. But I need to love her nonetheless. Then it goes on for a long time, and then it says, if none of this works, why don't you deeply consider the advantages of letting go of hatred and anger and practicing loving kindness? So there are 11 advantages. Do you want to know what they are? Well, I'll tell you anyway. One, you'll sleep well. So if you slept really crappy last night, you're probably interested. You'll sleep well if you practice loving kindness. Two, you'll wake up happy. You hear that little bell and you'll be, oh, thank you, Marissa. I'm so happy. Another day of practice. It's awesome. That'll be your first thought. Why are they laughing? Three, you will have dreamt no evil dreams. So had a really wonderful night. So it's interesting, 3 out of the 11 are about sleep. So we kind of pretend sleep is just something that happens privately in the background or doesn't happen. That's another huge thing about stress in our world, right? Our contemporary world. There's a massive sleep or, you know, insomnia epidemic, you know, massive. Most of us are not sleeping well. What's that doing? Four, you're dear to human beings. So people really like you better. So we really like that. I love you. Five, you're even dear to non-human beings. So animals and plants and rocks are delighted when you come along. Six, the gods watch over you. Seven, fire and poison don't affect you. That could be handy. Eight, your mind is easily concentrated. So there's a connection here between concentration and kindness. Nine, the expression on your face is always serene. So you're like a Buddha, you know? 10, you will die unconfused and content. And then it says, if you penetrate no higher, meaning you don't go like further than this with the teachings, if you penetrate no higher, you will be reborn into the heavenly Brahma realm. It's like I was saying earlier, and just have that enormous long lifetime of bliss. So that would be nice. So some of this seems very quaint to us in the language, and it's all in translation. But what's it all pointing to? This really seems to be saying quite emphatically that if we practice loving kindness towards all beings, we become content. We sleep well, we're relaxed, we're happy. We're in accordance with the world, our minds are settled, we're really fine. And when it comes to die, we know that that's going to happen, right? When it comes to die, we'll die without confusion and suffering. This is another thing that we kind of try to keep in the background, like not sleeping. This is like the biggest not sleeping, right? That we're all dying. And actually, when I was telling you yesterday about, you know, that it's safe to turn off your phones, and the camp managers will give us messages very efficiently, I was thinking about one time at this retreat. We were all outside doing walking meditation, like you just were. It's beautiful, by the way, to come through and watch you all walking in the sunshine. I don't know if you were inwardly serene or not, but I was filled with joy and delight watching you. Anyway, we're out there walking in exactly that situation, and the camp manager comes and gives me a note. It's a message for one of the participants who's right across the lawn, walking back and forth. There she is. Saying to please call home immediately. Her father has suddenly taken seriously ill and is in the hospital. I gave her the message and she instantly collapsed in tears, gathered up her things and drove home. Made it to the hospital just before he died, but only just. When she left, he was fine. No health problems that she knew about. She got home to witness his death. So we just don't know, right? We don't know when. It's not when or if. We don't know when we will die, our loved ones will die. We're all passing quickly from the earth. And it really changes the feeling of our lives to allow that into our hearts. Practice is not something we can really do later, right? Because what if there's no later? And isn't it wonderful that this practice doesn't shy away from that, you know? We practice loving kindness deeply for our lifetime, we will die unconfused. And I've been at, you've probably been at deaths that were confused and deaths that were unconfused. And sometimes the person dying can really comfort their relatives as they go. So beautiful. Other times not. So, but the amazing thing that's behind all of this, which is really important, is that we really can change. And that these practices help us change inner patterns and beliefs and reactions and patterns that we think are just me, just my personality or something. Our personality is just an emergence that's not as solid or rigid or permanent as it appears. Sometimes it doesn't really seem like anything's happening. We can be very frustrated because we're within the frame of view of that fixed sense of ourselves. And sometimes the patterns by which this stuff unfolds can be surprising. And almost always kind of non-linear. I studied math and science, so I like this term, non-linear, you know what I mean? Like, linear would be this leads to that, just in a straight line, you know? Straight graph. More meditation equals more happiness. But it seems to not work that way. Not a line. More like a crazy squiggle. You know, but over time, the crazy squiggle does seem to rise. Like warm air, just naturally. Here's a great story from the meditation teacher Sharon Salzberg. It's a little bit third hand, so if you actually know Sharon, forgive me if I get this a little wrong. Sharon Salzberg is a great advocate of loving kindness practice, has written books on it, does endless retreats on it. So she tells a story that early on in her 20s or something, she was very gung-ho about the practice, but also very frustrated. She had somehow put herself into a long period of practice, a long retreat in a monastery in Burma. So kind of like this 5 days, which is like, you know, 5 months or something of this, you know, maybe longer. And the emphasis of the practice the teacher was giving her were these practices, loving kindness, visualizing someone you like, may they be happy, may they be joyful, may they be peaceful, blah, blah, blah. Visualizing somebody you don't like so much, may they too be happy. May they too be peaceful. So on. Trying to visualize yourself. May I be happy. And just feeling like this isn't working. I'm just making this up. This is so rote. I'm a failure at this. day after day. And I've known a few people who have practiced in Burmese monasteries, and they pretty much give you like 10 minutes of instruction and leave you alone 12 hours a day to carry it out, you know. So she's doing that. And then she gets a message, kind of like the message I mentioned, some crisis at home. She has to, and home's far away, so she flies home and is staying back with her parents. You can imagine the culture shock. You're trying to believe in yourself as a, like a Burmese, you know, monk in training or something, and you're back home, you know. Your parents don't get it, probably. But anyway, then she like knocks over something in the house, knocks over a vase or a glass or something, and this thing crashes to the floor in a million pieces. And she finds herself saying a very familiar line with a very familiar feeling. Oh, Sharon, you're such a klutz. Probably with some nastier language in there than that. And then, seemingly out of nowhere or out of some deep somewhere, she finds herself saying, and I love you anyway. I love you anyway. So this is the fruition of these practices. We're still a mess, you know, we're still impatient, we're still grouchy. And I love you anyway. People, the troublesome figures in our lives and our world are still troublesome. But we love them too. So this is the important thing. These practices lead little by little to transformational change, but we don't always see it coming. This first one, bringing up this intention towards positivity, towards love and kindness, is supported by the other three, which will gradually weave them together over the week. But it's a good place to start. May I, too, be loved and lovable and kind. This can be slow and frustrating and really hard to believe in a world that's burning, a world with so much anger and confusion and criticism and destruction. Can we meet this whole world as it is? This is not like trying to pretend everything's okay. Meet it as it is, with love. So here's a little poem to close. Thank you for listening. I do sometimes go on a long time. It's a piece by somebody called Rosemary Traumer called One Morning. It's sometimes quoted in MSC class, so the MSC people, maybe you've heard this before. One morning we will wake up and forget to build that wall we've been building. The one between us. The one we've been building for years. Perhaps out of some sense of right and boundary, perhaps out of habit. One morning we will wake up and let our empty hands hang empty at our sides. Perhaps they will rise as empty things sometimes do when blown by the wind. Perhaps they will simply not remember how to grasp, how to rage. We'll wake up that morning and we will have misplaced all our theories about why and how and who did what to whom. We will have mislaid all our timelines of when and plans of what. And we will not scramble to write these plans and theories anew. On that morning, not much else will have changed. Whatever is blooming will still be in bloom. Whatever is wilting will wilt. There will be fields to plow and trains to load and children to feed and work to do. But in every moment, in every action, we will feel the urge to say thank you. We will follow the urge to bow. One morning we will wake up, we will wake up, and forget to build that wall we've been building. So maybe that's how it goes, you know? Not some big, incredible flash of insight, but one morning realizing, I'm not such a, you know, I'm not so angry anymore, you know? And there's work to do. Thank you very much.